is so great. This is just so exciting. The first time I'm doing this, and I welcome everybody, and I thank you, Rabbi Kalman, for this great opportunity, and I thank you, Reb Shalom, for all of the support. This is just a wonderful program, and I'm very, very excited and honored to be part of it. Tonight we're going to be speaking about the topic of Agunot. Agunot, when there's a husband who is missing, and the question is he alive or not, and collecting evidence to determine that the husband indeed has passed away, so in order the woman can be declared an almana and be able to remarry. I'm going to talk about with specific focus on the World Trade Center Agunot and how this was these particular cases were resolved by the Basin of America, the Basin of the Orthodox Union and the Rabbinical Council of America. So the basic source that we're going to be using are the Mishnayos from Maseches Yevamos. So if anyone wants to grab a Maseches Yevamos, you're in good shape. You'll be able to follow along. If you don't have that with you, you can. I'll read the Mishnayos fairly quickly, and you'll be able to follow along without too much trouble. Okay, should I give people an opportunity to get the Mishnayos? Oh, Rabbi Yisrael got the Mishnayos. Okay. Okay, here we go. Let us begin. Rabbanim, great. Rabbanim throughout the generations have devoted much attention, an incredible amount of attention, to trying to resolve difficult gunah of resolving problems of a woman who's stuck because her husband is not sure if he's alive or not. And there's such an extensive literature on it that the extensive literature is illustrated by the following point. There's a books in Eretz Yisrael that are coming out known as the Otzar HaPoskim that summarizes the halachic literature on various topics. And there are 8 volumes just on the topic of Agunah. There's 1,500 pages. So this is incredible. 1,500 pages summarized discussions of Agunah. So in actuality, you probably have tens of thousands of pages that deal with the issue of Agunah. And this is all pretty much pre-20th century. And unfortunately, the 20th century has seen, has added a lot to this literature, unfortunately, a very bloody century. The World War I certainly had a disproportionate amount of Agunot, as did, of course, World War II, the problem with the Holocaust, with Moshe Feinstein, or Tzipa Frank had to deal with that. Rav Herzog had to deal with the issues of the War of Independence, the Agunot from that terrible war, from the 1973 Yom Kippur War. Rav Baggio Seif has an extensive literature describing how he resolved the Agunot from that particular also terrible war. And each particular incident. There's more issues that are added to the halachic literature because the technology changes and the new issues that come up. And the World Trade Center terrorist attack was no exception. There are many issues that have been added due to the new halachic breakthroughs that have come about through the dealing with the Aguna. And we'll try to pinpoint a number of those breakthroughs that have come about. However, of course, we all look forward to the day that this will all remain a theoretical topic and we never should have to deal with this again. It's just something to read about and to learn for Torah's sake, but not to have to deal with. But meanwhile, unfortunately, we have not gotten to that point of the Mashiach but it's at this point we still unfortunately have to deal with this. So let's start looking at Mishnayos step by step, and we'll use the Mishnayos as a base to discuss the issues of the World Trade Center Agunot. So we have Perek Tesvav, Mishnah Aleph, describes as follows. Ha'isha shehalcha hi u'balo medina sayan. The woman goes with her husband overseas. Shalom b'levem v'inav, shalom ba'olam. If there is, the husband and wife have been living together peacefully, and there is generally there's stability in the world, And a woman came home from the voyage and says, Meis Baali, the husband died while overseas, Tinase, we permitted to remarry. Now that itself was quite a statement. It's quite unusual, because it's saying that in halakha, even though if a woman claims and says, well, I received a get, she has no corroborating evidence, she doesn't have a get to produce, she doesn't have aid to support the fact that she received the get, we wouldn't believe her. But when it comes to aguna, the standards of evidence are relaxed and will allow a person to testify by themselves. And even people who are psulim lay, those people who ordinarily would not be acceptable for edus in testimony in Beis Din, they would be acceptable in cases of aguna. Now, there are a number of reasons why we're lenient. One of the reasons, I'll go through two of the reasons. One reason is that isha daika o mitzvah, that it's assumed that before a woman is going to make such a claim that the husband has died, that she's going to check the circumstances very carefully. And that's because if the husband's later found to be alive, the consequences for the woman are horrific. She would be, she would have to divorce both the second husband as well as the first husband. And she would, because it would be considered to be an adulterous relationship, and the children from the second marriage would be considered to be mamzerim. And it assumes that she engages in exhaustive research. In the World Trade Center Aguna cases, the Beis Din of America engaged in the extensive research on behalf of the Agunot. So in order that the Rabbanim, the great Rabbanim, who are heads of the Beis Din of America and other Bati Din throughout the world, who were consulted, that they can issue their rulings based on the exhaustive research that has been undertaken. So now, but on the other hand, we relax the standards for evidence, but in order just to try to avoid anyone trying to take advantage of those relaxed standards, we do the following. We have to make sure that there is shalom beinah ulveina, that there is tranquility between the husband and wife, and that the wife, and to remove the suspicion that the wife is not just trying to find a way out of the marriage to just by claiming the husband has passed away. We have to ascertain that it's shalom beino uveina. Just to return also to a statement to one point that I missed before, one of the reasons why we are, second reason why we're lenient regarding the aguna, we relax the standards of evidence, is not only because of we assume the wife is going to make engage in exhaustive research. Another reason is because people are not going to lie when they're easily caught in a lie. That's milsa avili gluye, lo avidi inshil neshaker. People are not going to lie when they can be caught in a lie. So if it's easy to lie about, let's say, if a food is kosher or not, because how do you know? Or it's filling is written with written in a proper way. There's no way to know. You just have to rely on the person. So the evidence, the standards of evidence would be very, very high. But here, a person would be very demotivated to lie, and therefore we try to make sure that therefore we are fairly lenient about the standards of evidence. So we'll admit one witness, we'll admit someone who's involved in the matter, the woman herself will accept her evidence, and now, another way that we balance out these relaxed standards is that the hallmark of a Beis Din proceeding regarding Agunot, and that is very stern warning, saying that you should know how strictly we consider this matter and how seriously we take it, and that it would be considered to be an awful avera if someone is not, it would be. Caught in a lie, that it would be considered to be reprehensible to the highest degree. So we normally warn witnesses in Beis Din, but when it comes to Agunot, to an Agunot proceeding, we warn with an extra heavy dose of severity to try to demotivate anyone from lying. Please, anyone, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to chime in or to write in the chat box to alert me to questions that you might have. Okay, let's go to Mishnah Vav in Perek Tes Vav Yevamos. Mishnah says as follows: Me'idin l'or haner l'or halavana, that we can give testimony on based on an event that you saw even only with candlelight or even moonlight. We may see an alpi baskal, that even if you didn't hear the voice directly, you hear it by an echo. And the mission tells us two stories in that regard, and I'm going to relate this to the World Trade Center terrorist attack. The mission says as follows: Ma'aseh be'echad she'al mar rosh ha'har, story with someone who stood on the top of a mountain and said, Ish ploni ben ploni mokom ploni meis. He announced about himself and said, I so-and-so, the son of so-and-so from such and such place, am about to die. Halchav lo matzu sham adam. They Rabbanim went and checked out the case and to see what happened, and it turned out that there was they couldn't find anybody, no evidence at all that this person had died, but the person was missing. But just based on the fact they heard this person, they didn't even see his voice. They just heard the voice of a person saying that I so and so am about to die. They trusted that hearing that person, even though they just heard a voice and they didn't see the person saying it. And here's another story the mission tells us. Reshuv Mas B'Talmon. Nachash, Arayni Meis. I, so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, I've been bitten by a snake and I'm about to die. V'halchu v'lo ikiruhu, and they found a dead body, but they couldn't recognize the body, couldn't identify the body. V'siru says, Ishto, and the same thing that they permitted the wife to remarry just based on that statement, and that the man had made, and even though they just heard him on his voice, they just heard his voice, they didn't actually see him, and that was enough, that was sufficient evidence, sufficient grounds to permit the wife to remarry. Now, if I can maybe throw out a question, let's see if anyone in our audience can figure it out. What would be a modern analog to these cases of hearing a voice but not seeing the person, or hearing a voice or hearing what the mission says, a bas call, hearing an echo? What would be an analogous situation in the modern situation? Would anyone like to chime in, either in the chat box or with words? Cell phones, that's correct. Bert, raise your hand, Bert. Bert, no? Oh, I don't know image. Okay, that's correct. That's so you chimed in correctly in the chat box. Cell phones from the people who are on the top of the World Trade Center. Unfortunately, I mean, or fortunately for the women, but in tragic situations, there were radio transmission from a boat. Wow, that's about to sink. That's right. That's cell phones and radio transmissions are excellent because the idea is that you can't see the person, but you can you can't see the person. You can hear them, and you can identify them by their voice. The voice recognition is here on the telephone. And it was a tragic situation of someone who called right before he was about right, and he called. He stayed on the cell phone with his wife right until the moment that he died. And tragic situations, but on that basis, Rav Adya Yosef permitted the wife to remarry. Very sad situation. But harking back to what we talked about before about the Beis Din having to engage in exhaustive research, how would the Beis Din back up, let's say, in a cell phone? Cell phones in the top of the World Trade Center. What would a Beis Din do? What's that? Oh, the Dakar. Okay, hold on with the Dakar for a moment. Okay. Before we get to the Dakar, I just want, what would you think in the cell phone from the top of the World Trade Center? How could a basin back up and try to do the exhaustive research to make sure that there was no foul play involved and that there's a true honest report? Well, cell phones, of course, you can call the cell phone company and get the records. So that would be a way in which the basin could engage in exhaustive research and make sure that that no one is no one is fudging the avatar. Yes. Okay. Rabbi Kelman raised in the chat box the question of the next about this story. The Dakar was was the story of an Israeli submarine that was in 1968, correct, Kalman?
I believe so.
And
I
was
just it gonna, was. Yeah, I was just going to ask if on the cell phones, they may have a record of the call, but how do they know where? Or can't they know where the call was actually originating from on a cell phone?
I think so.
If somebody calls his wife.
I think so.
At 9:15 on September 11th. So what?
Right. But I think they could tell where it comes from. So, certainly, if they call from a landline,
determine where the cell phone is coming from.
I think they can say where it came from. If I'm not mistaken. Or so I think they can come pretty close. Right. I think that's correct. Not as precise as a landline. They can come pretty close. Right. The phones communicate with the nearest cell tower. I hear. Okay. So that's one of the things that Rabbanim, they caught a killer that way. Okay, there you go. All right. Now let's go to the next issue. Let's go to Perek Tetzvad Mishnah Gimel. All the Mishnahs we're going to be focusing on in Maseches Yevamos. Mishnah says as follows, Ein me'idin ela al parsus panim lachotem. That the way you can identify a body is, oh, yeah, the Dakar. I'm sorry, right. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. I forgot about the Dakar. The Dakar was an Israeli submarine that sank in the Mediterranean in 1968, and they had a problem with the Agunot, with the husbands who were sailors in the submarine. How are they going to identify that they died? I'm not so familiar with the case. I don't know. Were there actually signals saying that they were dying? I think they didn't find the Dakar until very recently.
Right. My understanding in the case was, I'd have to look it up, but a submarine went missing, a Navy ship, and they never heard anything from it. There were like 68 people on it. They never heard a word from any of these people. And just
right.
You know, one would assume with 68 people, like, where do they go? It's like, I don't know, maybe it's mine, shamelessly, I'm soft. I don't know what the problem was exactly.
Right.
I'd have to look at it. It was never found, so it's okay.
It was never found, even though I thought they found it a couple of years ago. Okay. Yes, question from Rabbi Yisrael. Go ahead.
Would it help at all that in this day and age, particularly, let's say, North America, that you would probably also get a massive searched by the civil authorities? Let's say somebody was lost in a mountain, some hikers are recently lost, that you'll get a massive search to help verify the claims the person's disappeared?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of the things the Rabbanim relied on when it comes to the World Trade Center. There was no concern of somebody that there wasn't. They relied on the fact that it was an extensive search done in the World Trade Center. Absolutely. And when we talk about relying on government authorities, that's a very important point. Very important. Okay, let's go to Mishnah Gimel. How do you identify dead bodies? Mishnah says as follows: Ein me'idin ela al parsus panim lachotem. I'm sorry. Yeah, there is currently a case in Northern Ontario when someone fell off a boat and wasn't found, but there was a search.
Yeah, that's for those those of us in Toronto, we all know. I haven't heard anything on that case in the last number of months. Aaron, did you hear anything? There was a massive search. They never found anything. And I don't have a clue if they were Mutt or the wife. I don't know what her status is.
Mishnayos Yivamos Perkas of Mishneh Gil. Ein me'idin ela al parsus panim imachotem. That with the in order to identify a dead body, you need to see the entire. You have to find the face with the nose. Avo pishiyesh simanim begufo bekelav. Even though you can identify the body, the simanim, their means of identifying the identifying marks on the body, and it's closed. That's not sufficient. The only way to identify is you have to find the face with the nose. And ein me'idin, we'll skip ahead a little bit, ein me'idin el ad shlosha yom. So you need to have a face with the nose, and it only works if you find the person within 3 days of death, because after 3 days of death, the body starts to disintegrate, and you no longer can identify the person as a. You can know the person. The body can no longer be identified. So, in such a situation, the simplest case would be if you find the person. That we can rely on. So the Gemara already explains that even the Mishnah says we can't rely on identifying marks in the body. It depends what kind of identifying marks there are. If these are not very distinctive identifying marks, such as saying that the person is tall, or the person is short, or the person had a little bit of a ruddy complexion, a little bit of a dark complexion, that is not a simon. That is not an adequate identifying mark. However, if you have something that is highly unusual, if it was called a simon muvhak, that would be absolutely acceptable. And perhaps even a simon beinoni, if you have something that is a... simon beinoni together, two semi-adequate simonim, perhaps you can combine that together. So you have simon muvhak, which are adequate. You have semi-adequate by beinoni, and then garua. I'm going to get to dental records. Dental records are very important. Okay. So what's the standard? What makes a simon a simon muvhak? So what the post can quote that Beishmol, the Aruch HaShulchan, they say if it's unusual, if it's has to be less than 1 in 1,000, if less than 1,000 people have such an identifying mark, that would be a simen. Now, the Poskim taught, there's a lot of discussion, what is considered to be a simen? What body, what's the siman and body? And in the Otzer HaPoskim, which is an anthology of the Tshuva literature, the response literature on this topic, they're, believe it or not, they discuss about 200 body parts. What does the halacha say about it? There's a lot of cases that are discussed. I should add, by the way, that in Israel there'll be a lot of discussion on this because this is the law of the land. The law of Medinat Yisrael, you identify a dead person based on halacha because personal matters are within the jurisdiction of the Beis Din. In order for a woman to remarry, she has to be declared dead by the Beis Din. So there will be an extensive, unfortunately, there's been an extensive literature dealing with a lot of cases. As this is a government law in the state of Israel. Okay, but now so the standard for a simon muvhak is 1 in 1,000. So someone asked about dental records. So dental records is an excellent question because, and this also for the halacha changes from time to time. So the source were saying that that dental records would be acceptable as a Beis Shmuel. The Beis Shmuel writes, DNA. Whoa, DNA is a big issue. We're going to get to that very, very shortly. So the Beis Shmuel, the premier Mefarish too, the Shulchan Aruch writes that if there's a nekev b'shein, if you consider there's a hole in a particular, if you find a dead on the body, there's a hole in a particular tooth, That, the Beis Shmuel says, is a siman muvhak. That is an excellent siman. And but the Aruch HaShulchan says, not anymore, not in his time. The Aruch HaShulchan, writing in the late 19th century in the Vardic in Europe, he said, no, so many people, it's so common to have, for people to have holes in their teeth. So a nekev, a hole in a tooth is not a siman. So as the Aruch HaShulchan says, things, it's no longer a siman in our time. It's changed. And of course, today with superior dental records, dental care in this country and in Israel, for the most part, again, having a nekev b'shein, having a hole in a particular tooth, would be considered to be an acceptable simen. And in dental records, the Rabbanim do accept. Rav Moshe Feinstein accepted. There was a case that he discussed in the Igros Moshe when there was an Eastern Airline plane. Some of us, I think I still remember the case when I was a boy, that the Eastern Airline plane crashed at JFK. And in that case, Rav Moshe Feinstein ruled that in the 1970s, Rav Moshe Feinstein paskin that you can rely on the dental records. That's absolutely can rely on. And the Beis Din of America did rely on this when it came to the World Trade Center Agunot, in part. They use other considerations as well. Okay, so let's just again remind ourselves: we have siman muvak, siman beinoni, siman garua. Siman muvak is great. Siman beinoni, you have to combine two or three siman and beinonin to constitute an adequate siman. And siman garua is really pretty much useless. Some say you can combine a couple of siman and groin together, but basically, what you need is either a siman muvak or a siman beinoni. Okay, now here's the big issue that Bert raised. What about DNA? What do we say about DNA? Is it acceptable means to identify a dead body? So this was the issue in the World Trade Center Agunot, and it came to the fore in this case because. That's correct. It should be, right, Rabbi Kalman asked very well. Why is that a question? It's one in a billion. I mean, all you need is one in a thousand. You don't have a certain DNA test, not only one in a billion, it's one in a quintillion. So it's hard to find, it's hard to think what's a better siman muvak than I'm sorry? Help me, I'm sorry. Right, okay. So there's Ein Lecha Siman Muvak Gadol Mizeh. There's no more, how can you do better than with DNA evidence? But believe it or not, not everybody agreed with it. Let me first begin with Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg was in the great post in Yerushalayim, and he was the post that the Rabbanim from the RCA Basin consulted with, and the Beis Din of America, and he paskined that it was acceptable. He felt that it was an analogous to the rulings offered by the Netziv and Rav Yisrael Chanan, two great postmen in the 19th century, that allowed a photograph to constitute a evidence of death. There was a case that came up in Europe in the 19th century where a husband was missing. He was in England, and the London police sent to the woman's family photograph of the person's of the husband's body, and the Rabbanim paskened that constituted proper evidence. So Zalman Nechemya Goldberg said that the DNA evidence would be analogous to a photograph because it's a photograph, I guess, of the inner workings of the inner essence of a person of our bodies. But believe it or not, not everybody agreed to that, and they do have good reason for it, and that is, in general, the halacha does not consider something that is not visible to the naked eye. I'll give you an example. Let's see if I can illustrate it here. If you look at me on the screen, I'm gonna right on the internet. I'm about to eat something not kosher. Watch how I do it.
Not kosher. What I do?
See what I did? I just breathed. So when I breathe, I just ate something not kosher. I just breathe in bacteria, so the bacteria is not. How could I have eaten that? I'm a very frugal Jew. The answer is because it's not visible to the naked eye. So I don't, halacha doesn't have to consider something that I don't, that's not cognizable to the naked eye. So some wanted to make the argument that DNA, also we can't even consider DNA if it's not visible to the naked eye, which is a very good argument. But the Rabbanim respond as follows, that in general by Aguna we see we admit certain evidence that we normally wouldn't admit in Halacha. We admit Eid Echad, a single witness. We admit a hearsay. We meet Eid Mipi Eid. People who are normally not qualified to serve as who are not valid witnesses, we accept them. So even though we normally wouldn't accept DNA as evidence, but for Aguna, since the levels of evidence are relaxed, we would admit DNA. But the bottom line was that the Beit Din of America did use DNA evidence as a major consideration in their lenient rulings. And indeed, they found a lenient ruling for all the women that came to them for a ruling. There are 9 of them. And Rav Zalman Lechemi Goldberg certainly supported it. And Rav Vosner from Bnei Brak, along with Nissen Karelitz, also supported it. Not wholeheartedly, but they regarded it as a siman beta with other evidence, and then that would be sufficient. Okay, is there a teaching in the Sunday gives us the right to be more lenient to what except or the rules of testimony drop on it anyway? That's a good question. Right, in other words, it's one thing that the Rabbanim decided, okay, we'll accept 1A. Where do we have the right to say that normally we wouldn't accept DNA, but here we would accept. Normally we wouldn't accept DNA, but for Aguna we would accept DNA. Question. That's a good question. But maybe in terms of the idea is that as long as we for Aguna, what we're looking for is information, not necessarily testimony. So even though you have testimony, a woman testifies, a wife testifies, that's information, it's not testimony. So DNA can constitute information even though it's not testimony. It doesn't constitute testimony, it's not edus, because it is not cognizable to the naked eye. That's one possibility. You know, there's another reason why the Rabbanim weren't too interested in accepting, or were very hesitant in accepting DNA evidence. To matter agunos, you know, DNA evidence can cause a lot of problems in other areas of halacha. Can anybody figure out what that would be? Where would it be a huge problem if we're going to start? Okay, Yerusha. Yerusha, that's an interesting point. But there's something where else it could be even more problematic and can tell us information that we don't want to... Mamzerus. My sister-in-law chimed in. Correct. Correct. That's right. Very good. Who is a Jew? Mamzerus is a big problem that you can't rectify, so we'd rather not know that somebody's a mamzer, so if you want to... I'm sorry? Oh, that's a good question. Okay, how do we know the DNA is from the dead missing person? Good. So what they do is as follows. What is in the World Trade Center is a husband who was missing, a person that was missing. They would ask the family to give a sample from a DNA sample from a toothbrush or a hairbrush, and if they didn't have that, the DNA from a close family relative. So for a child or a parent, they would take the DNA from the child and the parent and compare it to the bodies that they, the DNA evidence they found on the unidentified body. See if it matches up with the DNA and the for either from the family members or from the toothbrush. Yes.
So what happens in the Mamzer case?
Okay.
DNA evidence.
Does the fact no one survived have any impact? Okay, we're going to talk about that. We are going to get that very, very shortly. Actually, let's go to Dalet. Let's go to Mishnah Dalet, Perek Tesvav. Hakol Ne'eman Laida. Everyone is accepted. Yes. Yes, I'm listening.
Sure. If DNA evidence to... I understand to use it to be mafia mumser, but, right, so you started raising the problem on DNA, it can reveal too much information vis-a-vis a mumser, so how does the person deal with that? Or would they rely on it to be mafia mumser, first of all?
To rely to be mater mamzer, that's an interesting issue, maybe. But what they, we could look at a side as far as a mamzer is concerned, because it can prove parentage, but it doesn't prove that an adulterous relationship took place. The only time Rav Moshe Feinstein Paskins that artificial insemination does not create a mamzer. So it could be. Maybe the child came about through artificial insemination. That's some of the Rabbanim wanted to make that argument. We accept DNA as... Rabbi Kalani not coming in.
DNA evidence to be mater mumser.
To be mater mumser.
I understand you only want to use it in a Aguna case. In other words, somebody who thought it was a mumser could bring DNA evidence somehow to show it he wasn't. I imagine there could be such a case.
Okay. Maybe. But I'll tell you, with the Rabbanim, when it proves that someone is a mumser, let's say it proves that the husband is not the father of the wife's children, then in that case, we could ignore the DNA. We would ignore the DNA evidence because we'd say that we'll accept DNA evidence for Aguna, where the laws, the rules of evidence are relaxed, but not for other areas of halacha. That's how we've managed to use DNA for the good, but not for the quote unquote bad. So the things we want to use it for, and the things we don't want to use it for. It's an interesting issue. It's a very interesting issue. Okay. Let's go now to the next Mishnah Dalet in Perek Tesvav. Wow, we have a lot to cover and we're running out of time. Hakol ne'amanim la'ida chutz mechamoso. Says that everyone is considered to be trustworthy to offer evidence regarding the husband died, except for the mother-in-law or the sister-in-law. They're not believed. So somehow we're afraid that the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law are not getting along so well, and that the mother-in-law is trying to is trying to mess up the daughter-in-law. When the husband will show up and the woman is already remarried with new kids, and the mother-in-law will get her, it'll be the greatest day ever that she'll be able to mess up her daughter-in-law. So we're concerned that this happened. Now it's interesting that we see that if we're concerned that certain people have an axe to grind, we wouldn't believe them. The Gemara applies this in terms of non-Jewish governments. We wouldn't believe them to say that somebody's dead or that they killed somebody, because we consider that the only reason why the government is saying that is because they're trying to, maybe they heard that somebody's missing and they want to claim, we're concerned that they're claiming, that they'll hear that somebody's died and they claim they killed them in order to create an image for themselves that really tough, when in reality they didn't kill a person, they're just lying. So this became a very big issue. In general, even the non-Jew, we only rely on their regarding an aguna if they are mesiach, if they are just speaking speaking out of innocence. They don't realize that they are addressing a halakhic issue. But if a government is question is how much do we rely on a non-Jew? And we say maybe the government is different, than it was in the time of the Gemara. So this came about in the 19th century, right? Some of the Rabbanim, like the Sam Sofer, felt that we can start relying on governments. And indeed, we find that in the 20th century became in the Russian, if they said a soldier in their army died. It's interesting, so normally the government, we would rely that somehow that they want to maintain the credibility. That's what Rabbanim wanted to say in the 19th and 20th century. Well, what about a company? This came up already in the World Trade Center. Would a company be relied on America, was American Airlines? Can you rely on American Airlines reporting that so-and-so was on the plane, because there was an Orthodox man on one of the planes coming from Boston that the terrorists slammed into the World Trade Center. So if he was on the plane, there were no survivors. But the question, how do you know he was on the plane? So if American Airlines reports that he was on the plane, then the question is, do you rely on American Airlines? So this, again, was one of the breakthrough rulings regarding the World Trade Center, Agunot, and that was you could rely on American Airlines because they would have absolutely no reason to want to say that somebody was on their plane and died if it wasn't true. Why should they want to, that they have all reason not to say that somebody was on that plane? If they say they're on their plane, they're just increasing their exposure to liability suits. So to a lawsuit, and therefore, Rezalman Khamiv Goldberg felt that he ruled you can rely on American Airlines as far as that report. Okay, now let's start. Let's go to Perek Tetzayin Mishnah Dalet. Yes, people. I don't think it's true that these people hate each other today. Okay, that could be. No, there's a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law. Maybe it's different today. All right, I hear. I didn't know if Elmi, there was any case that came about in the World Trade Center. I can hear already saying that. Interesting issue. Maybe. Okay, let's go to Mishnah Dalet. Nafal Amayim Bein Shei Shem Sof Bein Shei Lem Sof. Perek Tetzayin Mishnah Dalet. If a husband fell into a water, whether it is bounded or it is not bounded, the wife is not permitted to remarry. We actually paskin that if the husband fell into a water where it was visible boundaries and they didn't find the body, that should permit the wife to remarry. Mishnah tells us as follows. Rabbi Yossi says, "Masi basuma shirat litbo b'ma'ara." Tragic case where a blind man went to immerse himself in a cave. And his assistant went together with him, and they both drowned, and there was no trace of them. And both the assistant and the blind person's wives were permitted to remarry. Tragic situation. So, but the rule is what emerges from this is that if nobody is found and it's a mayim and the person was lost in the water with a visible boundary, we would permit the wife to remarry because we don't have to be concerned. Maybe the husband got out and went survived because if it's a mayim yeshlem sof, it has the visible boundaries. We would have seen the husband come out of the water. But if the husband was lost in the mayim she'ein lehem sof, it's a famous phrase, ocean of water that has no visible boundary, we have to be concerned that maybe the husband was down. It was lost downstream and got up, and found his way, and somewhere way downstream, and they have no idea that he's alive. So that's why the Rabbanim said if the husband is lost in a situation with a mayim she'ein lahem sof, then with non-visible boundaries, the wife would not be permitted to be remarried. Now, someone may raise the question. Very serious question. That why, even in that case where the husband is lost in a mayim she'ein lahem sof, why are we so afraid that the husband is not alive, the husband is downstream? That would be highly unusual. Why don't you follow Rov? Rov, the majority of people who are lost in the mayim she'ein lahem sof are no longer alive. And in most cases, and we find throughout the Torah, we rely on Rov. We all drink milk. How do you drink milk? Because we have a cow, the milk is from, maybe that animal is a trade for, and you can't drink the milk. The answer is we rely on a rove. We rely on a rove vein was ksheros ninu, that most animals are kosher. So we rely on rove all the time. How come to allow a woman to be now, you don't want to rely on a rove? The answer is this is a chumrah that the Rabbanim imposed. That that even though in most likely the man has died, nevertheless we do not permit the woman to remarry. It's a chumra midrabbana. Okay, but now we have to see: would there be any exceptions? Reb Chaim Volozhin, the famous Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, and Reb Chaim Volozhin is the ancestor of Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. Great, great, great grandfather. Reb Chaim Volozhin dealt with the following case in Vilna. A husband, it was in the middle of the winter, and a husband fell off a bridge in Vilna, and he fell onto the ice in the he was still alive. So you can't rely just on that rove. On the fact that it's most likely he died as a result of the fall. However, what happened was that then the body was lost in the river, and this river was a mayim she'ein lahem sof, and the body was never recovered. Do we permit the woman to remarry? So Reb Chaim Volozhin said in a breakthrough ruling that you can allow the woman to remarry because what you have here is trei rubi, two majorities. In other words, if there's one rove, we don't allow a woman to remarry. But here there are two roves. Most people who fall off of a bridge onto ice die, and most people who are lost in icy water die. So based on that, Reb Chaim Volozhin allowed the woman to remarry. Reb Moshe Feinstein relied on that in World War II. In the where a case where a pilot fell, plane was hit above the English Channel, and it fell into the English Channel. So you can rely on that either most pilots in a plane that falls from the sky and hits the water die from the plane the body was lost in the sea. So most people lost in the sea die. So that's a tray ruby, okay. That's a modern example. That's a 20th century example. Yes, Yisrael, a question. Yes, you want to write in the chat box?
I'm sorry?
I didn't hear you.
Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Would there be...
I can hear you.
There might be a difference between bounded water, unbounded water, right? She'ein lahem sof. Like a river and an ocean.
Right.
Because if a guy falls in a river, he might wind up downstream. But if a guy falls in an ocean and doesn't get out, and you don't see him, you can fairly well assume that he couldn't make it out.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, okay, that's a good point. That is very good. Very good point. Okay, I haven't seen the literature on that, but I hear you. That's good. Good point. Very good. I think you're right. Now, let's keep this, let's bear this Trey Ruby principle in mind. We go to the, some of the details of the World Trade Center. Let's go to the timeline. Now remember, the World Trade Center had two towers. The first tower that was hit was the North Tower. The second tower was hit was the second was the South Tower. The North Tower was hit at 8:46 a.m. and it was hit between floors. The planes penetrated between floors 93 and 98. The first plane penetrated between floor 93 and 98. And what that did was it cut off all the elevators and stairwells, and anyone who was from the 92nd floor or above had no way of getting out. So, using the language of the Mishnah, the Northern Tower at 8:46 a.m. became what? It became a Mayim Sheyesh Lamsof. Not a Mayim Sheyesh Lamsof. There was no outlet. So there was no way. There was no way out. So the 92nd floor and above was engulfed in flames immediately. And that would bring us to a case discussed in the Gemara that if a person fell into a kivshan, a cauldron of fire, that you can assume that the person had died. So, unfortunately, the World Trade Center from the 92nd floor and above, starting from 8:46, was a cauldron of fire, Nebuch. And anyone who there's evidence that he was in the Northern Tower at 8:46. Can be presumed, it was presumed dead. Now, how do you know the person was in the tower after 8:46? So, if you have the people who call on their cell phones at 8:52, at 8:50, so you have evidence that they were in the Northern Tower after 8:46, in the 92nd floor or above. That's good enough evidence. That was a relatively easy case to resolve. But there were a couple of people who called from their offices at 8:20. So this was a very, very big issue. They were in the Northern Tower at 8:20 a.m. So can you assume that they were still in the Northern Tower at 8:46? So this goes to the halachic principle that's called chazaka, that you maintain the status quo. So normally, you know, we're used to the concept of chazaka. How do we know the Erev is still up on Shabbos? You check the Erev on Erev Shabbos. Quote. How do you know men in our audience? How do you wear tefillin every day? How do you know it's kosher? Since the last time it was checked, the answer is we assume the status quo. So the question here is that we know the halacha says you can't rely on rov for to be matur naguna, but can you rely on chazaka? Can you rely on the status quo? Can you assume the status quo is maintained? Zalman Lechemi Goldberg in another breakthrough World Trade Center ruling said you can rely on a chazaka. Not everybody agreed with that. A lot of Rabbanim felt that you can't rely on a chazaka. If you can't rely on a rov, culture gain shouldn't be able to rely on a chazaka because you have a principle, ruba chazaka, ruba adiv. If you have a conflict between a rov and a chazaka, the Gemara Kedushin tells us that rov is a more potent tool to resolve a question. And so, therefore, we'd say if rov is more a potent tool than a chazaka, then, if we don't rely on a rov, culture game shouldn't rely on a chazaka. But Zalman Lechemi Goldberg argued that if we rely on chazal specifically exclude rov, but if they didn't explicitly exclude chazaka, we can rely on chazaka. And so Paschman was Zalman Lechemi Goldberg. But he had something else to his that helped him out as well, and that is as follows. I'm going to develop this particular point. And that is, there's a chazaka plus a rov, and that is, in the modern situation, you have a lot easier to primatur and aguna than in the time of the Mishnah. In the time of the Mishnah, a man could have been swept down a river 50 miles downstream, and he'd have a hard time communicating to his wife that he's still alive. But today, there's good reason to be more lenient. It's fascinating to see this through the centuries, the postmen try to be a little more lenient about this issue. You find the Trumas Hadesh in the 12th century said, well, maybe we should be more lenient in our times, the communication is better. But that wasn't accepted by the Shulchan Aruch. In the 19th century, the Chassam Sofer said, but there's a post office in every town. So you can rely on that if he was alive, that he would have sent the letter. Right? Some of the Rabbanim said, maybe. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, we have phones now. So there's better communication. And if he was alive, he would have said that he was alive. That's Rav Moshe Feinstein write about people who are lost in the Holocaust. And then about Vajio State dealing with the World Trade Center cases, he said, well, look, now we have cell phones. There's even easier ways of communicating. So, lost and have not been heard from, you can assume that they are not alive. So you can have that rov plus the chazaka. Okay, so that's how the Rabbanim were matir the case in the Northern Tower. See, even if they just placed a phone call at 8:20 to say that to call their wives and say that they arrived they're at work in the Northern Tower, and if they were there at 8:20, we don't have to be concerned that they left. Okay, we combine the chazaka that they remained in the Northern Tower with the rov. The majority of people, if they survived, they would have communicated. If they didn't survive, if they didn't communicate, it means most likely they had died. Okay. What if there's no fun? Someone's still on the subway on the way to work. I'm going to talk about that. Okay. That is, we still have to get to that. We're getting there, and we're going to finish up. I don't have too much time. I'm going to try to go to see if we can finish. Let's finish up. Note, Trade Center. Oh, okay. Wow, we're going to talk about that. Wow, oh my God, it's unbelievable. Wow, that's remarkable. Wow, Baruch Hashem. Wow. Okay. Okay. Now what about the South Tower? Can I ask Rabbi Yisrael, which tower were you in? Where were you in the World Trade Center at the when the plane hit? Okay, wow.
So when the towers came down, I was within the radius of them. So they fell, all the debris fell around me.
Okay. But, you weren't in the World Trade Center. All right. Let's now talk about people in the tower. Okay. Let's talk about the people in the South Tower. The South Tower was him. Between the planes hit between floors 84 and 87, and from floor 78 and above, only 10 people survived. Now, the South Tower was a Mayim She'en Lehemsof. It wasn't a Mayim She'en Lehemsof. It was not analogous to bounded water, because there was one stairway that was left open, and there was stairwell A, and there were 10 people who survived. Right after the plane hit, as they ran right, they were standing by stairwell A. They ran into it. They managed to survive. So the South convenient is that if you were able to get them some evidence that the person was on the 78th floor above after 9:02 in the South Tower, you can rely on Trey Ruby. There are two rows. First of all, that most people in the South Tower, 78th floor above, after 9:02, did not survive. And even those that did survive, they would only survive if they would have been hospitalized, because they sustained pretty major injuries. So we don't have to worry that maybe the husband had survived the South Tower and had escaped, because had he escaped, he would have survived. Okay. Yes. Couldn't you rely on the proof? You can rely on that partially. That's helpful. But we want to rely on other areas as well. You're right. So that partially made right. You could say Mayim She'en Lehemsof plus improved communication. So you have two rows. Yeah, there's room to say that. The Rabbanim were a little bit shying away from that. Okay, the hardest. Two more points. What if somebody was in the South Tower? We can know that they were on the floor 78 above. And let's say at 8:20. Was that enough evidence that the husband has died? Anybody or audience, what do you think? No, that wouldn't be enough evidence, because, see, in the World Trade Center, in the Northern Tower, if someone's there at 8:20, there was nothing to disturb the status quo that would make him leave. But if someone was in the South Tower at 8:50, you have a phone call that he was in the South Tower at 8:50, that's not proof that he was in the Southern Tower at 9:02. Because it was very likely, a lot of people, when they heard that the North Tower was hit, they ran out of the South Tower. So there was the status quo of people being in the South Tower was disturbed. So just proving that the person was in the South Tower after 8:46, between 8:46 and 9:02 is insufficient proof. Yes, except that you're right. They did tell him to stay in the South Tower, but there were plenty of people who disregarded, who wisely or whatever, or just who had the guts to disregard that order. You're right. It's less reliable to rely on the chazaka in that case. You can rely on chazaka on status quo unless there's something to disturb the status quo. I'm running out of time, so let me just finish up. There was one husband who they weren't able to. They didn't find the body. They didn't have any communication. They didn't know. There's one husband who worked in the Northern Tower, but they didn't have him communicating after 8:46, not before 8:46. And they had a big problem. So, but what they did was they did. He came in from. I'll change the facts a little bit just to protect privacy. He came in from a bus from Westchester. And then he boarded a train down to the World Trade Center. So they have that particular husband. They have witnesses that saw him get on the bus to go in Westchester, go into New York City at the time that would get him to the World Trade Center before 8:46. And also this person, they got his MetroCard records. The Bank of America did a lot of research. They had some nice connections. So they were able to get the person's MetroCard records. So they knew that he got into the subway heading to the World Trade Center. And they got him in enough time that would get him to 8:46 to get to the Northern Tower by 8:46. Beth got their hands on the subway records. The subway records showed that subway that he boarded had no experience, no delays. They had elevator records that this particular husband's elevator records, because the World Trade Center for security had required you needed a pass to get into the elevator. He swiped the pass and looked at his records and from all months of August and September through September 10th, and using the information based on when he got out of the subway, when the subway that he boarded reached the World Trade Center station, and how long it would take him to get from the subway to up the elevator to his office, which was above the 92nd floor in the Northern Tower. It looked like he got there by 8:40. Looked like he for 8:45. That's what it seemed. So the question is, can Rabbanim rely on that? Can you rely on a person's patterns? So that's a different kind of a chazakah. Chazakah that a person follows their normal patterns. Sirchei Konaka. The Gemara has this. In Gemara Brachos, if you're not sure, and Brachos says Zion, if you're not sure where you're holding in terms of Kriyat Shema, are you on the first of Saptam, the second of Saptam? So if you started saying Laman Yerbuyimechem, we assume that he has already said the second of Saptam, Alma Zot Vesakov Yishrecha. Because we assume that if he said Ulaman Yerbu Yimechem, that he's finishing up the second parsha. We assume people we follow our normal patterns. So if we know the person got on the correct bus, the correct subway, and the subway got there on time, so we assume that he followed his patterns that he did on most of his work days, that he reached that he got to the Northern Tower. There's some precedence for the Taz had a case. Where a woman, going back to the old days when the women used to salt meat in the house, where she was cooking meat and she wasn't sure whether she salted the meat. So the Rabbanim said you can rely on, the Taz said, one of the great posts from the great Mepharshim Shulchan Aruch, he says you can rely on the Chazaka. You can rely on the Chazaka, they followed the normal pattern. The Dvar Yoshua, one of the great Dayanim in Tel Aviv, it was a case in 1950 where, someone was killed, so there was a missing husband from a terrorist bombing of a bus in Tel Aviv in 1950, and that husband normally would take that bus to go home. He said you can rely on that. And if you can rely on these cases, certainly on here we have a lot more evidence that technology allows us to resolve this question. So the Rabbanim gave a heter, and after they get the heter, they found the husband's DNA. Very tragic, tragic stories, but it compounded, and they were able to find a heter for all of the for all of the agunot with a good of America, but also with support from two great gedolim from Eretz Yisrael, Rav Zalman Chaim Goldberg and Rav Avadji Yosef. I hope you found this this an informative discussion. Thank you so much for coming to this breakthrough in technology. This is just so exciting, so incredibly exciting to have this technology. And again, the huge yeshiva to Rabbi Kalman, to Rabbi Shalom Eisenstadt, and to our technical manager, am I allowed to say his name? David Callender. This is a great schus to give Torah this way, and Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm sure, is is smiling, looking down at this, how Torah can be communicated in such a beautiful way.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Everybody is free to stay on board and to schmooze and to talk to their friends, whatever. But if you have any comments or suggestions, you know, as the technology is in infancy stages. So we'll, you know, we're happy to hear what you have to say. You can email us, and thank you very much. Next week, Monday night, the topic is?
The prenuptial agreements. We talk about a different kind of agunas, the husbands who are not giving gets or women not receiving gets. I know people don't think that women don't that never happens, but I want to tell you, I'm a Masada get. I'm a get administrator, and yesterday I administered four gets yesterday, and I was supposed to do a fifth, but the woman decided not to show up. So the husband is all in a panic because we've been trying to get a get for about 5 months, and the woman has been refusing. So we'll talk about how prenuptial agreements can be the one that's been presented by the Rabbinical Council of America, how that's, that can be very, very helpful. We'll talk about the Aguna problem and how the prenuptial agreements are a very, very powerful tool to help virtually eliminate the problem, hopefully completely eliminate the problem. Thank you for Marcia. Thank you for your kind words. Yisrael, thank you. Judah, thank you. Rabbi Kelman Senior, thank you. Rabbi Kelman, Rabbi J. Kelman, thank you.
I'm Jay, and my father's Rabbi Kelman. That's
Mark,
how it works. All right. Have a good night, everybody. See you next week. Bring your friends. Thanks. Bye.